Welcome to Beyond the Chain, the podcast from Nash that takes a deep look into blockchain technology and connects the dots between decentralized finance, business, and the wider world. I'm your host, Chris Fenwick, and each episode I'm joined by a Nash founder and a special guest.
This week I'm here with co-founder Luciano Engel. Also here is our back-end engineer Alan Peabody. Luciano and Alan work together on the trading and accounts team. Luciano is familiar to some followers, but perhaps hasn't been as vocal as other founders at Nash. So perhaps this will be a good opportunity to get to know you a little better.
Well, I'm a graduated mechanical engineer and also a serial entrepreneur. And I think Nash is my third or fourth startup. Pretty much all of them were with Fabio. We are college mates, actually. And the story how we got here, I mean, it's intertwined with the COC history, which it's interesting because actually me and Fabio were looking for a new platform to start a new startup back in Brazil, which would be something in the same terms as Nash, but much, much smaller and in Brazil. And then Fabio discovered about Neo and started contributing to the community. And then COZ happened and all those opportunities appeared. And then, wow, Nash kind of came from all that. But it was really, really occasional for us. We weren't expecting any of that. So it was really, really great.
Alan, would you like to let us know a bit about your background?
I came through a software engineering program. I've been writing software particularly for the web and APIs for over 10 years now. Done a lot of sort of data processing over that time, working with large streams of data. So that's actually been very applicable at Nash. Immediately prior to Nash, I was actually at a niche social media startup that went pretty well. And I actually just started poking around and I saw this ad in the Elixir Slack channel. And so I jumped and I was really excited for the interview. I actually didn't think I had a chance because I had no blockchain experience. But my experience with Elixir, I think, was a very strong draw for the Nash crowd. And I came out of that interview really, really psyched. And I've been excited to be here ever since.
Yeah, it's great to have you here. So, guys, how would you characterize the work of the trading and accounts team? It's kind of a mixture of both front-end and back-end elements, right?
Yeah, it goes back and forth. There is several front-end elements along with back-end elements, but especially me and Alan, we tend to focus more on the back-end since we are back-end engineers. This past month, I've been trying to, as CDO, overwatch more the front-end guys and how the things go over there. But I feel like I know much more about the things going on into the back-end still.
Yeah, so since we've got you and Alan here today, we'll focus more on back-end. I think it'll be especially interesting to talk about questions of the speed of the exchange and the matching engine. Nash has a unique settlement system where we have a matching engine that manages state channels across a number of blockchains. However, is it the case that the actual matching engine component itself that matches trades between users, is that significantly different from other exchange matching engines?
I would say they are pretty similar, at least to the models that I found when doing research. From the very beginning we started this, it works pretty closely to that.
So I guess the major difference is how it communicates with the outside world, settles trades.
Yeah, I mean, I expect it so, right? We try to do everything from the very beginning in such a way that everything is deterministic and fair. So you kind of hope that everyone else is doing the same thing around, right?
Could you talk a little bit more about what it means for the matching engine to be deterministic? Why is this important and how do we achieve it?
So I guess if you talk about what determinism really means, it means we receive a set of events, and this order of events is persisted within our system. And every time we play those events in that specific order, the result of it is always the same. And that's pretty important because, one, for fairness, because with that, we can ensure that the orders are executed in a fair manner, and they will match in a fair way. And we won't have orders front running others or anything like that. And the other reason why this is so important for our system particularly is because our system works in memory. So every state is in memory. And in order to, if the system crash or anything, we need to replay actually those events in that very order to recreate the last state we had before we crashed. So if our system isn't deterministic, when we do replay those events, there will be inconsistencies between the data that we have in the matching engine memory and the data that we have in the exchange itself. So if that happens, our data is corrupted and the system simply won't work. So we need to ensure that every time we do that, every time we replay events, everything is consistent. And maybe Alan can talk a bit of how hard and the implications of that within Elixir.
Sure. The determinism, you know, like Luciano said, determinism in computer science is the same inputs always produce the same outputs. So for us, that has been a very difficult challenge, particularly when you start talking about scale and performance, because the biggest and easiest way to scale something, to be able to handle more traffic and handle more requests, is to do more things in parallel. However, doing things in parallel is hard when you're trying to be deterministic, because something could be faster one time and slower another, and then all of a sudden your outputs are in a different order. So for us, that has definitely been one of our bigger challenges, is making sure that our deterministic processes are, one, fast and scalable, and two, they are and stay deterministic, especially as we've been, as Luciano said, working in memory and to provide some of that speed.
And I think actually that's especially interesting for the Elixir case, right? Because Elixir is such a language that makes doing parallel work really natural. And it's kind of going against the flow just to be trying to be single-threaded in Elixir or to be deterministic in it, right?
Yeah, I mean, we're basically doing everything the wrong way in Elixir to get a really good result.
So what would be the right way to do it in Elixir?
So the right way to do something in Elixir is to have a ton of concurrency. So have everything happening in parallel. So if you had 100 orders come in, you'd have 100 different processes processing those orders. That would mean you don't have that guaranteed ordering. You don't have the, you know, it gets even more complicated when you start thinking about a single user who has funds. So say I'm trading really quickly and I want to buy some Bitcoin with USDC. And then I immediately want to turn around and sell that BTC for ETH for whatever reason. That's the order I want to go in, right? We have to make sure that those orders execute in the same sequential order. They can't happen out of order, especially if you're expecting to reuse those funds in the second order. So when you get into concurrency situations, and especially when you start talking about replay or even having multiple matching engines running, those are the kind of scenarios that can be very difficult.
So what is it that we do that's wrong that makes it work?
We focus on using what we call our deterministic executor. So we do everything sequentially in one process, in one thread, which is not the Elixir way. We use a lot of processes and threads for a lot of other things, and we use a lot of other parts of the Erlang VM and the Elixir ecosystem that are the right way to do things in Elixir. But that one in particular is very unusual.
Yeah, actually, a great part of our jobs is finding places where we can actually take the processing time and execution time out of the deterministic path so we can execute them in parallel, right? And improve performance.
Right. So you take something like our blockchain signatures. You know, when you start talking about the settlement and how we interact with the chain, all of the orders have a blockchain signature on them. So something like that can be handled asynchronously. We can, or out of the deterministic path, we can sort of verify that that blockchain signature matches the order, matches the information we have on the user. We can do those sort of things asynchronously so that we're removing as much work as we can from our single thread process.
In general, what elements affect the speeds of an exchange? Like what elements affect the number of orders an exchange can process, this sort of thing?
So when you think about it, if you're placing an order, there's actually a lot of things that happen. The first thing that happens for you as a user is you have to generate, you know, you put in your inputs, right? You say, okay, I want to buy this or sell this, it's a limit order or whatever. Then you actually, that request, you end up creating a blockchain signature for that. And then you also end up signing the whole request payload to say, this is something that with my private key that I'm signing this payload saying, I wrote this. Then you send that request up to our API server. So the first sort of overhead in terms of processing speed is always that network overhead, that work on the client and the request overhead.
So it's basically how long it takes for the order to be signed in the client and then to be sent to our system.
Right.
Once it's in our system, that's sort of like the numbers we're extremely careful with measuring. We do a lot of monitoring and measuring of all of these requests to make sure that we know exactly how long this is taking for, you know, 99% of our requests. But once it hits our API, we're deserializing that. We're authenticating that this request came from a valid session. At that point, we're then actually queuing it, so putting it in our order enforcing stream of events to get sent to the matching engine. At that point, once the matching engine gets it, we have to validate it. We have to verify those blockchain signatures. We have to verify the request signature that you sent. We register the blockchain data with the settlement system. We, you know, verify and lock the funds, so make sure you actually have the funds available. And then finally, we go, so actually hit the order book where we're, okay, hey, you've placed this order. Is it going to take immediately, right? Is it going to take liquidity from the market? And then once that phase is done, we then, you know, say, okay, is this a limit order? Should we become a maker and be on the order book? At that point, we're also then unlocking and exchanging the funds, finally generating the response, sending it back to the API, and then from the API, serializing it and sending it back to the client. So that's sort of the life cycle of an order. Nash.
And that's to say only on the matching engine, right? Because it will still take a moment until it can actually see that order. Because what happens is once this all is done, the matching engine will emit those events relating everything that happened from that event. Like if you place an order, you can actually generate several trades. And actually some orders might be completed or other orders might be canceled or anything like this. So pretty much all the results of you placing that order, they are output into a specific topic that is then read by another application, which we call projections, that reads everything that the matching engine spits out and kind of builds this views that we then show back to the user back in the platform, right? Like your order, how much you paid, what state is it, what percentage of it was filled, and things like this.
Though sort of crucially for the functioning of the exchange is the latency time and then the processing in the matching engine, whereas projections is how fast the front end can update the information the user sees.
Yeah, I mean, I would argue that it's all important, particularly if you're making decisions based on the information that you're seeing in the front end, in the UI.
Yeah. Once you place an order, everything you get from the matching engine is an okay order placed. What really gives you the result of what that order means for the order book will be projections, right? So you can take actions on it.
And that's also the case if you're trading through the API.
Exactly, especially the case, yeah.
I see. So projections is also important for people doing algorithmic trading.
Yes.
Because they also get their data from it.
Yeah, and the latency there is very quick. The way I like to think about it is the matching engine has sort of like this very specific model of the data that's optimized for placing orders, executing trades, you know, switching funds. It's very much optimized for its path. However, as a user, you want to see a bunch of different things, right? You want to see the candles. You want to see the history of trades. You want to see all of these sort of views into the data, how much volume you've done, how much volume everyone's done. So to generate all those different views, that's all based on orders coming in and trades being executed, we basically have to take that data and parse it and calculate it in a bunch of different ways. And that's something we do in a very parallel manner. And it's also extremely fast. I think our typical latency between the matching engine and projections is like under 10 milliseconds. So it's very, very fast there.
And in general, how fast would you say that Nash is in terms of latency? So including users placing orders.
So 95% of our orders are handled in under 100 milliseconds. That's at the API boundary, right? That doesn't include your network overhead. If you're placing an order from Hong Kong or somewhere really far away from our data server, obviously the latency on the network overhead latency is larger. But yeah, 95% of orders under 100 milliseconds.
So what sort of things can we do to increase the speed?
Well, so we talked a bit about that deterministic execution path. Moving stuff out of the deterministic execution path is very beneficial for us. I will say that actually with that 100 milliseconds is actually the deserialization the sending it to our ordering queue, the authentication, all those types of pieces. Once it actually gets to the deterministic executor, 95% of our orders are less than 2 milliseconds. So there's a lot of stuff in there that we just can continue to optimize.
Yeah.
To be very clear, 98 milliseconds out of 100 are not in the deterministic executor.
So it's just constant optimization of everything in the deterministic executor.
Not only there, there are many places around it as well. Like Alan said, plenty of this stuff, like Cyrus sending to our queue and everything, all of this happens before the actual deterministic executor, right? And actually are the things that take the longer for us. And the things that we are focusing more this past months in trying to come up with a better system and even faster.
So when you talk about the queue, is that the Kafka event stream?
Exactly, yeah. Kafka is a queue, is a line of events. It's kind of a something that ensures that once you put an event there in a specific position in a line in a queue, it will remain there and the order will be maintained. And that is pretty important for us, like we said before, for fairness and guarantee the data status on the matching engine so we don't have corrupted state.
Yeah, you can almost think of it as a log file, although it's not actually a file, right? But it's this log of entries like order request, cancel order, those kind of log entries with all the data that are in a log. And when we're reading, we're saying, okay, the last thing I read was this line, and now I'm just reading all the new things from there.
But you're saying that there's work that we can do to improve on this.
Yeah, we're actually in the midst of experimenting with alternative tools to Kafka, in particular Redis streams, to try to improve some of our latency.
Yeah, and some of that is because we use a third-party service to provide Kafka. Because Kafka is not a straightforward tool to manage with in the house, I guess, or it would give us even more headaches than what we already have now. And so there is all the networking between us and then and everything. And of course, this adds up to our overall latency. So we are trying to use like simple tools, things that we can easily manage within our own network. And with that, improve latency.
So determinism is important for being able to prove that the matching engine is fair. Who is actually able to see this proof at the moment? Is this just something we can see in-house or is there a plan to make it available to the public in the future?
I mean, right now, the way we know it's being fair and working is because we don't have corrupted state when we replay the events. And it's actually an issue for our system if we do. If we change anything there, our data will be corrupted, and Alan knows what I'm talking about. It needs to be correct. Everything needs to fit there in order to work properly. Other than that, I don't think we have right now an idea or plans to make this queue open, because in the first place, this is like a raw tool, right? I don't think opening it up makes any sense. We would need some kind of, I don't know, queue explorer of sorts so people could check the ordering in there. And even so, it might be even pretty complicated for regular people to go there and, oh, hey, I want to check if my order was properly executed.
I mean, I think in blockchain, it's not the regular people who are asking these kinds of questions. It's the people who are sort of obsessed about being able to see exactly what is executing. So these are definitely a minority of users.
Yeah, I agree. But at the same time, in blockchain, there's a lot of people who are not tech savvy enough to understand Kafka or what does it mean to be or how to read the logs. So we would need to make this digestible to them, which would be a product of itself, I think. Mm-hmm. So that is not our plan right now. But one thing I can say is that people, and I think this applies to a lot of stuff in our product overall, people tend to undervalue what means to be compliant. And I think that's really important to get right, because being compliant means that we are being audited all the time. There's people looking at our things. We have actually a specific admins page where auditors can check up orders and trades, and we have to export all the trades and send to them in order for us to pay taxes or things like this, because we are breaking grounds in terms of compliance and legislation and regulations and everything. And that has a pretty heavy toll on the things that we actually need to provide and give to them so they can actually keep supporting us. And it's not easy. It's a lot of things. So even if people aren't looking at that queue and saying like, oh, hey, my order was fairly executed, rest assured that we have the government and the FMA and everything auditing us all the time and taking a look into that.
The other challenge with that data is just the volume of it. It's a little bit like trying to sip from a, you know, fire hose, right? We're doing 2 to 3 gigabytes per hour of data right now. So that's a lot to be sort of trying to filter through and look at unless you have a very specific use case.
What challenges have you faced at Nash that are maybe different from previous jobs? What do you think is maybe more difficult? What's more interesting?
I can say that managing a team remotely was pretty challenging for me at the beginning. Now I think we're getting better at it, but it was a long road until we get here, until we understand how things work remotely, how to find the right people. I think finding the right people is very important in order for this to actually work. Another thing that was pretty challenging, I think, was the first steps in code, actually, in the matching engine and everything. Because now we have such a giant code base, really complicated, but I mean, there's a lot of tooling already there. And on the very beginning, when we were just like writing the first modules, it was really, really scary and challenging the amount of work we'll need to be done.
Yeah, I think that's an interesting observation. The amount of sort of like internal specific tools that we've written just to help make building things easier or make debugging or introspection into what's going on in the system easier has actually been a significant investment in time. But for me personally, I think the most challenging thing has probably been sort of throwing out some of that, what we mentioned before about our single process, doing things wrong in Elixir. Doing things wrong in Elixir to have a really solid, fast product. That's taken a little bit because my instinct was always to reach for concurrency, for reach to do things sort of in a way that's not so deterministic. So getting the performance at the deterministic level has been a big challenge for me personally.
Okay, well, thanks guys for being here today. I've certainly learned some new things about our system that I didn't know before. So thank you, Luciano.
No worries, anytime. Thank you, Chris.
Thanks, Alan.
Yeah, thanks for having me, Chris.
And thank you for listening to Beyond the Chain. Subscribe with your favorite listening stream and you won't miss an episode. You can also find the full text of this episode on podcast.nash.io.